Then you could have returned sooner, but didn't?
That's true. But that's all I can tell you.
Where were you, Dagny?
Do you mind if we don't talk about it now? Let's wait until I see you.
Of course. I won't ask any questions. Just tell me, are you safe now?
Safe? Yes.
I mean, have you suffered any permanent injuries or consequences? She answered with the same sound of a cheerless smile.
Injuries? No, Hank. I don't know as to the permanent consequences.
Will you still be in New York tonight?
Why, yes, I'm back for good.
Are you?
Why do you ask that?
I don't know. I guess I'm too used to what it's like when I can't find you.
I'm back.
Yes. I'll see you in a few hours. His voice broke off as if the sentence were too enormous to believe. In a few hours, he repeated firmly.
I'll be here.
Dagny.
Yes?
He chuckled softly. No, nothing. Just wanted to hear your voice a while longer. Forgive me. I mean, not now. I mean, I don't want to say anything now.
Hank,
when I see you, my darling. So long.
She stood looking at the silent receiver. For the first time since her return, she felt pain, a violent pain, but it made her alive because it was worth feeling. She telephoned her secretary at Taggart Transcontinental to say briefly that she would be in the office in half an hour. The statue of Nathaniel Taggart was real when she stood facing it in the concourse of the terminal. It seemed to her that they were alone in a vast, echoing temple, with fog coils of formless ghosts weaving and vanishing around them. She stood still looking up at the statue as for a brief moment of dedication. I'm back were the only words she had to offer. Dagny Taggart was still the inscription on the frosted glass panel of the door to her office. The look on the faces of her staff as she entered the anteroom was the look of drowning persons at the sight of a lifeline. She saw Eddie Willer standing at his desk in his glass enclosure with some man before him. Eddie made a move in her direction but stopped. He looked imprisoned. She let her glance greet every face in turn, smiling at them gently, as at doomed children, then walked toward Eddie's desk. Eddie was watching her approach as if he were seeing nothing else in the world, but his rigid posture seemed designed to pretend that he was listening to the man before him.
Motive power, the man was saying in a voice that had a brusque staccato snap and a slurred nasal drawl together. There's no problem about motive power, you just take...
Hello, said Eddie softly with a muted smile, as to a distant vision. The man turned to glance at her. He had a yellow complexion, curly hair, a hard face made of soft muscles, and the revolting handsomeness belonging to the aesthetic standards of barroom corners. His blurred brown eyes had the empty flatness of glass.
Miss Taggart, said Eddie in a resonant tone of severity, the tone of slapping the man into the manners of a drawing room he had never entered. May I present Mr. Meggs?
How do you do, said the man without interest,
then turned to Eddie and proceeded as if she were not present.
You just take the Comet off the schedule for tomorrow and Tuesday and shoot the engines to Arizona for the grapefruit special with the rolling stock from the Scranton coal run I mentioned. Send the orders out at once.
You'll do nothing of the kind, she gasped, too incredulous to be angry. Eddie did not answer. Meggs glanced at her with what would have been astonishment if his eyes were capable of registering a reaction.
Send the orders, he said to Eddie, with no emphasis, and walked out.
Eddie was jotting notations on a piece of paper.
Are you crazy? She asked.
He raised his eyes to her as though exhausted by hours of beating.
We'll have to, Dagny, he said, his voice dead.
What is that? She asked, pointing at the outer door that had closed on Mr. Meggs.
The director of unification.
What?
The Washington representative in charge of the railroad unification plan.
What's that?
It's... Oh, wait, Dagny, are you all right? Were you hurt? Was it a plane crash?
She had never imagined what the face of Eddie Willers would look like in the process of aging, but she was seeing it now. Aging. At 35, and within the span of 1 month. It was not a matter of texture or wrinkles.
It was the same face with the same muscles, but saturated by the withering look of resignation to a pain accepted as hopeless. She smiled, gently and confidently, in understanding, in dismissal of all problems, and said, extending her hand, "All right, Eddie. Hello." He took her hand and pressed it to his lips, a thing he had never done before, his manner neither daring nor apologetic, but simply and openly personal. "It was a plane crash," she said. "And, Eddie, so that you won't worry, I'll tell you the truth. I wasn't hurt. Not seriously. But that's not the story I'm going to give to the press and to all the others. So you're never to mention it." "Of course." "I had no way to communicate with anyone, but not because I was hurt. It's all I can tell you, Eddie. Don't ask me where I was or why it took me so long to return."
"I won't."
"Now tell me. What is the railroad unification plan?"
"It's..." "Oh, do you mind? Let Jim tell you. He will soon enough. I just don't have the stomach."
"Unless you want me to," he added, with a conscientious effort at discipline. "No, you don't have to. Just tell me whether I understood that unificator correctly. He wants you to cancel the Comet for 2 days in order to give her engines to a grapefruit special in Arizona?"
"That's right."
"And he's canceled a coal train in order to get cars to lug grapefruit?"
"Yes."
"Grapefruit?"
"That's right."
"Why?"
"Dagny. Why is a word nobody uses any longer." After a moment, she asked,
"Have you any guess about the reason?"
"Guess? I don't have to guess, I know."
"All right, what is it?"
"The grapefruit special is for the Smather brothers. The Smather brothers bought a fruit ranch in Arizona a year ago from a man who went bankrupt under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. He had owned the ranch for 30 years. The Smather brothers were in the punchboard business the year before. They bought the ranch by means of a loan from Washington under a project for the reclamation of distressed areas such as Arizona. The Smather brothers have friends in Washington."
"Well?"
"Dagny, everybody knows it. Everybody knows how train schedules have been run in the past 3 weeks and why some districts and some shippers get transportation while others don't. What we're not supposed to do is say that we know it. We're supposed to pretend to believe that public welfare is the only reason for any decision, and that the public welfare of the city of New York requires the immediate delivery of a large quantity of grapefruit."
He paused, then added, "The Director of Unification is the sole judge of the public welfare, and has sole authority over the allocation of any motive power and rolling stock on any railroad anywhere in the United States."
There was a moment of silence.
"I see," she said.
In another moment, she asked,
"What has been done about the Winston Tunnel?"
"Oh, that was abandoned 3 weeks ago. They never unearthed the train. The equipment gave out."
"What has been done about rebuilding the old line around the tunnel?"
"That was shelved."
"Then are we running any transcontinental traffic?"
He gave her an odd glance.
"Oh, yes," he said bitterly. "Through the detour of the Kansas Western?"
"No."
"Eddie, what has been happening here in the past month?"
He smiled as if his words were an ugly confession. "We've been making money in the past month," he answered.
She saw the outer door open and James Taggart come in, accompanied by Mr. Meggs. "Eddie, do you want to be present at the conference?" she asked. "Or would you rather miss this one?"
"No, I want to be present."
Jim's face looked like a crumpled piece of paper. Though its soft, puffed flesh had acquired no additional lines. "Dagny, there's a lot of things to discuss, a lot of important changes, which," he said shrilly, his voice rushing in ahead of his person. "Oh, I'm glad to see you back. I'm happy that you're alive," he added impatiently, remembering. "Now, there are some urgent..."
"Let's go to my office," she said.
Her office was like a historical reconstruction restored and maintained by Eddie Willers. Her map, her calendar, the picture of Nat Taggart were on the walls, and no trace was left of the Clifton Losey era. "I understand that I'm still the operating vice president of this railroad?" she asked, sitting down at her desk.
"You are," said Taggart hastily, accusingly, almost defiantly. "You certainly are, and don't you forget it. You haven't quit. You're still..."
"Have you?"
"No, I haven't quit." "Now, the most urgent thing to do is to tell that to the press. Tell them that you're back on the job and where you were and..."
And by the way, where were you?
Eddie, she said, will you make a note on this and send it to the press? My plane developed engine trouble while I was flying over the Rocky Mountains to the Taggart Tunnel. I lost my way, looking for an emergency landing, and crashed in an uninhabited mountain section of Wyoming. I was found by an old sheep herder and his wife, who took me to their cabin deep in the wilderness, 50 miles away from the nearest settlement. I was badly injured and remained unconscious for most of 2 weeks. The old couple had no telephone, no radio, no means of communication or transportation, except an old truck that broke down when they attempted to use it. I had to remain with them until I recovered sufficient strength to walk. I walked the 50 miles to the foothills, then hitchhiked my way to a Taggart station in Nebraska.
I see, said Taggart. Well, that's fine. Now, when you give the press interview...
I'm not going to give any press interviews.
What? But they've been calling me all day. They're waiting. It's essential.
He had an air of panic.
It's most crucially essential.
Who's been calling you all day?
People in Washington and others. They're waiting for your statement.
She pointed at Eddie's notes. There's my statement.
But that's not enough. You must say that you haven't quit.
That's obvious, isn't it? I'm back.
You must say something about it.
Such as what?
Something personal.
To whom?
To the country. People were worried about you. You must reassure them.
The story will reassure them if anyone was worried about me.
That's not what I mean.
Well, what do you mean?
I mean...
He stopped, his eyes avoiding hers.
I mean...
He sat searching for words, cracking his knuckles. Jim was going to pieces, she thought. The jerky impatience, the shrillness, the aura of panic were new. Crude outbreaks of a tone of ineffectual menace had replaced his pose of cautious smoothness.
I mean...
He was searching for words to name his meaning without naming it, she thought, to make her understand that which he did not want to be understood.
I mean the public...
I know what you mean, she said. No, Jim. I'm not going to reassure the public about the state of our industry.
Now you're...
The public had better be as unreassured as it has the wits to be. Now proceed to business.
I
proceed to business, Jim. He glanced at Mr. Meggs. Mr. Meggs sat silently, his legs crossed, smoking a cigarette. He wore a jacket which was not but looked like a military uniform. The flesh of his neck bulged over the collar, and the flesh of his body strained against the narrow waistline intended to disguise it. He wore a ring with a large yellow diamond that flashed when he moved his stubby fingers.
"You've met Mr. Meggs," said Taggart. "I'm so glad that the two of you will get along well together."
He made an expectant half-pause, but received no answer from either.
"Mr. Meggs is the representative of the Railroad Unification Plan. You'll have many opportunities to cooperate with him."
What is the Railroad Unification Plan?
It is a new national setup that went into effect 3 weeks ago, which you will appreciate and approve of and find extremely practical.
She marveled at the futility of his method. He was acting as if by naming her opinion in advance, he would make her unable to alter it.
It is an emergency setup which has saved the country's transportation system.
What's the plan?
You realize, of course, the insurmountable difficulties of any sort of construction job during this period of emergency. It is temporarily impossible to lay new track. Therefore, the country's top problem is to preserve the transportation industry as a whole, to preserve its existing plant and all of its existing facilities. The national survival requires...
What is the plan?
As a policy of national survival, the railroads of the country have been unified into a single team, pooling their resources. All of their gross revenue is turned over to the Railroad Pool Board in Washington, which acts as trustee for the industry as a whole and divides the total income among the various railroads according to a more modern principle of distribution.
What principle?
Now, don't worry. Property rights have been fully preserved and protected. They've merely been given a new form. Every railroad retains independent responsibility for its own operations, its train schedules, and the maintenance of its track and equipment. As its contribution to the national pool, every railroad permits any other, when conditions so require, to use its track and facilities without charge. At the end of the year, the pool board distributes the total gross income, and every individual railroad is paid not on the haphazard, old-fashioned basis of the number of trains run or the tonnage of freight carried, but on the basis of its need. That is, the preservation of its track being its main need. Every individual railroad is paid according to the mileage of the track which it owns and maintains. She heard the words. She understood the meaning. She was unable to make it real, to grant the respect of anger, concern, opposition, to a nightmare piece of insanity that rested on nothing but people's willingness to pretend to believe that it was sane. She felt a numbed emptiness, and the sense of being thrown far below the realm where moral indignation is pertinent. She had listened, hearing through his words the sound of Reardon's voice, saying to her on a spring evening over a year ago, "They need some sort of sanction from us. I don't know the nature of that sanction, but, Dagny, I know that if we value our lives, we must not give it to them. If they put you on a torture rack, don't give it to them. Let them destroy your railroad and my mills, but don't give it to them."
"Now do you see?"
"Oh, yes, Jim. I see." He could not interpret the sound of her voice. It was low. It was part moan, part chuckle, part triumph. But it was the first sound of emotion to come from her, and he plunged on with no choice but to hope.
"I promised them in Washington that you'd speak. We can't fail them. Not in an issue of this kind. We can't afford to be suspected of disloyalty. It's all arranged. You'll be the guest speaker on Bertram Scudder's program tonight at 10:30. He's got a radio program where he interviews prominent public figures. It's a national hookup. He has a large following. He reaches over 20 million people. The office of the morale conditioner is..."
"The what?"
"The morale conditioner. That's Chick Morrison. Has called me 3 times to make sure that nothing would go wrong. They've issued orders to all the news broadcasters who've been announcing it all day, all over the country, telling people to listen to you tonight on Bertram Scudder's hour."
He looked at her as if he were demanding both an answer and the recognition that her answer was the element of least importance in these circumstances. She said, "You know what I think of the Washington policies and of Directive 10-289?
At a time like this, we can't afford the luxury of thinking."
She laughed aloud.
"But don't you see that you can't refuse them now?"
he yelled. "If you don't appear after all those announcements, it will support the rumors. It will amount to an open declaration of disloyalty." "The trap won't work, Jim."
"What trap?"
"The one you're always setting up."
"I don't know what you mean."
"Yes, you do. You knew, all of you knew it, that I would refuse. So you push me into a public trap, where my refusal would become an embarrassing scandal for you. More embarrassing than you thought I'd dare to cause. You were counting on me to save your faces and the necks you stuck out." "I won't save them."
"But I promised it."
"I didn't."
"But we can't refuse them. Don't you see that they've got us hogtied? That they're holding us by the throat? Don't you know what they can do to us through this railroad pool? Or through the Unification Board? Or through the moratorium on our bonds?"
"I knew that 2 years ago." He was shaking. There was some formless, desperate, almost superstitious quality in his terror, out of proportion to the dangers he named. She felt suddenly certain that it came from something deeper than his fear of bureaucratic reprisal, that the reprisal was the only identification of it which he would permit himself to know, a reassuring identification which had a semblance of rationality and hid his true motive. She felt certain that it was not the country's panic he wanted to stave off, but his own, that he and Chick Morrison and Wesley Mooch and all the rest of the looting crew needed her sanction, not to reassure their victims, but to reassure themselves, though the allegedly crafty, the allegedly practical idea of deluding their victims was the only identification they gave to their own motive and their hysterical insistence. With an awed contempt, awed by the enormity of the sight, she wondered what inner degradation those men had to reach in order to arrive at a level of self-deception where they would seek the extorted approval of an unwilling victim as the moral sanction they needed, they who thought that they were merely deceiving the world.
"We have no choice," he cried. "Nobody has any choice."
"Get out of here," she said, her voice very quiet and low. Some tonal quality in the sound of her voice struck the note of the unconfessed within him. As if never allowing it into words, he knew from what knowledge that sound had come. He got out. She glanced at Eddie. He looked like a man worn by fighting one more of the attacks of disgust, which he was learning to endure as a chronic condition. After a moment, he asked, "Dagny, what became of Quentin Daniels?" You were flying after him, weren't you?
Yes,
she said.
He's gone.
To the destroyer. The word hit her like a physical blow. It was the first touch of the outer world upon that radiant presence, which she had kept within her all day, as a silent, changeless vision, a private vision, not to be affected by any of the things around her, not to be thought about, only to be felt as the source of her strength. The Destroyer, she realized, was the name of that vision here in their world.
Yes, she said dully with effort, to the Destroyer.
Then she closed her hands over the edge of the desk to steady her purpose and her posture, and said with the bitter hint of a smile, "Well, Eddie, let's see what two impractical persons like you and me can do about preventing the train wrecks." It was 2 hours later when she was alone at her desk, bent over sheets of paper that bore nothing but figures, yet were like a motion picture film unrolling to tell her the whole story of the railroad in the past 4 weeks, that the buzzer rang, and her secretary's voice said, "Mrs. Reardon to see you, Miss Taggart." "Mr. Reardon?" she asked incredulously, unable to believe either.
"No, Mrs. Reardon."
She let a moment pass, then said, "Please ask her to come in." There was some peculiar touch of emphasis in Lillian Reardon's bearing when she entered and walked toward the desk. She wore a tailored suit, with a loose bright bow hanging casually sidewise for a note of elegant incongruity, and a small hat tilted at an angle considered smart by virtue of being considered amusing. Her face was a shade too smooth, her steps a shade too slow, and she walked almost as if she were swinging her hips. "How do you do, Miss Taggart?" she said in a lazily gracious voice, a drawing-room voice, which seemed to strike in that office the same style of incongruity as her suit and her bow. Dagny inclined her head gravely. Lillian glanced about the office. Her glance had the same style of amusement as her hat, an amusement purporting to express maturity by the conviction that life could be nothing but ridiculous. "Please sit down," said Dagny. Lillian sat down, relaxing into a confident, graceful, casual posture. When she turned her face to Dagny, the amusement was still there, but its shading was now different. It seemed to suggest that they shared a secret, which would make her presence here seem preposterous to the world, but self-evidently logical to the two of them. She stressed it by remaining silent. "What can I do for you?"
"I came to tell you," said Lillian pleasantly, "that you will appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight."
She detected no astonishment in Dagny's face, no shock, only the glance of an engineer studying a motor that makes an irregular sound.
"I assume," said Dagny, "that you are fully aware of the form of your sentence?"
"Oh, yes," said Lillian.
"Then proceed to support it."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Proceed to tell me."
Lillian gave a brief little laugh, its forced brevity betraying that this was not quite the attitude she had expected.
"I'm sure that no lengthy explanations will be necessary," she said. "You know why your appearance on that broadcast is important to those in power. I know why you have refused to appear. I know your convictions on the subject. You may have attached no importance to it, but you do know that my sympathy has always been on the side of the system now in power. Therefore, you will understand my interest in the issue and my place in it. When your brother told me that you had refused, I decided to take a hand in the matter. Because, you see, I am one of the very few who know that you are not in a position to refuse."
"I am not one of those few as yet," said Dagny. Lillian smiled.
"Well, yes, I must explain a little further. You realize that your radio appearance will have the same value for those in power as the action of my husband when he signed the gift certificate that turned Reardon Metal over to them. You know how frequently and how usefully they have been mentioning it in all of their propaganda?"
"I didn't know that," said Dagny sharply.
"Oh, of course. You have been away for most of the last 2 months, so you might have missed the constant reminders, in the press, on the radio, in public speeches, that even Hank Reardon approves of and supports Directive 10-289, since he has voluntarily signed his medal over to the nation. Even Hank Reardon. That discourages a great many recalcitrants, and helps to keep them in line."
She leaned back and asked in the tone of a casual aside,
"Have you ever asked him why he signed?"
Dagny did not answer. She did not seem to hear that it was a question. She sat still, and her face was expressionless, but her eyes seemed too large, and they were fixed on Lillian's, as if she were now intent upon nothing but hearing Lillian to the end.
"No, I didn't think you knew it. I didn't think that he would ever tell you," said Lillian, her voice smoother, as if recognizing the signposts and sliding comfortably down the anticipated course. "Yet you must learn the reason that made him sign, because it is the same reason that will make you appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight."
She paused, wishing to be urged. Dagny waited.
"It is a reason," said Lillian, "which should please you, as far as my husband's action is concerned. Consider what that signature meant to him. Reardon Medal was his greatest achievement, the summation of the best in his life, the final symbol of his pride, and my husband, as you have reason to know, is an extremely passionate man, his pride in himself being perhaps his greatest passion. Reardon Medal was more than an achievement to him. It was the symbol of his ability to achieve, of his independence, of his struggle, of his rise. It was his property, his by right. And you know what rights mean to a man as strict as he, and what property means to a man as possessive. He would have gladly died to defend it rather than surrender it to the men he despised. This is what it meant to him, and this is what he gave up. You will be glad to know that he gave it up for your sake, Miss Taggart, for the sake of your reputation and your honor. He signed the gift certificate surrendering Reardon Metal under the threat that the adultery he was carrying on with you would be exposed to the eyes of the world. Oh, yes, we had full proof of it, in every intimate detail. I believe that you hold a philosophy which disapproves of sacrifice, but in this case you are most certainly a woman, so I am sure that you will feel gratification at the magnitude of the sacrifice a man has made for the privilege of using your body. You have undoubtedly taken great pleasure in the nights which he spent in your bed. You may now take pleasure in the knowledge of what those nights have cost him. And since... you like bluntness, don't you, Miss Taggart? Since your chosen status is that of a whore, I take my hat off to you in regard to the price you exacted, which none of your sisters could ever have hoped to match.
Lillian's voice had kept growing reluctantly sharper, like a drill head that kept breaking by being unable to find the line of the fault in the stone. Dagny was still looking at her, but the intensity had vanished from Dagny's eyes and posture. Lillian wondered why she felt as if Dagny's face were hit by a spotlight. She could detect no particular expression. It was simply a face in natural repose, and the clarity seemed to come from its structure, from the precision of the sharp planes, the firmness of the mouth, the steadiness of the eyes. She could not decipher the expression of the eyes. It seemed incongruous. It resembled the calm, not of a woman, but of a scholar. It had that peculiar luminous quality, which is the fearlessness of satisfied knowledge.
"It was I," said Lillian softly, "who informed the bureaucrats about my husband's adultery."
Dagny noticed the first flicker of feeling in Lillian's lifeless eyes. It resembled pleasure, but so distantly that it looked like sunlight reflected from the dead surface of the moon to the stagnant water of a swamp. It flickered for an instant and went.
"It was I," said Lillian, "who took Reardon Metal away from him."
It sounded almost like a plea.
It was not within the power of Dagny's consciousness ever to understand that plea, or to know what response Lillian had hoped to find.
She knew only that she had not found it, when she heard the sudden shrillness of Lillian's voice.
"Have you understood me?"
"Yes."
"Then you know what I demand and why you'll obey me. You thought you were invincible, you and he, didn't you?"
The voice was attempting smoothness, but it was jerking unevenly.
"You have always acted on no will but your own, a luxury I have not been able to afford. For once and in compensation, I will see you acting on mine. You can't fight me. You can't buy your way out of it with those dollars which you're able to make, and I'm not. There's no profit you can offer me. I'm devoid of greed. I am not paid by the bureaucrats for doing this. I am doing it without gain, without gain. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
"Then no further explanations are necessary. Only the reminder that all the factual evidence, hotel registers, jewelry bills, and stuff like that, is still in the possession of the right persons and will be broadcast on every radio program tomorrow, unless you appear on one radio program tonight. Is this clear?"
"Yes."
"Now, what is your answer?"
She saw the luminous scholar eyes looking at her, and suddenly she felt as if too much of her were seen, and as if she were not seen at all. I am glad that you have told me, said Dagny.